This episode is brought to you by Fat Expats. It's the new expat magazine that's coming your way next month. If you'd like to find out more about it, head over to twofatexpats.com. You'll see a pop-up and you can sign up and we'll shoot you some information. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kirstie Rice. I'm all good. It's June in Hamburg and there's sunshine. This continues to be the most surreal calendar year ever.
And that is surreal because it's 2020, it's COVID time. You can't, oh, well, you can get out in the sun now, can't you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We've been very lucky. We've had, it's been called Corona Zeit Wetter, meaning the weather during the time of Corona has been good the whole time. It's so weird. It's an anomaly in the weather system.
Oh, well, Nikki, it's a special day today in South Australia. The South Australian government just announced that they're going to let 2,000 people go to the showdown, which is, of course, the football.
What?
Which is the football game between Adelaide and Port Adelaide. And within seconds of the announcement being made, I was on the phone to the football club saying, okay, how's this going to work? And the man told me.
Because this is massive because there are no, there. So football started. Rugby league started in other states and AFL started in the southern states and there's no crowds allowed.
No crowds. No, there are no crowds allowed. And what is particular about this game, and, you know, it's not going to happen for a while, is it is the one game in South Australia because it's the two South Australian teams.
Yes.
And, of course, we have zero cases. So, yes, they've said 1,500 tickets and it will be the whole golden ticket Willy Wonka style. We're having a ballot and you'll just get notified by email if you're lucky.
Oh, yeah. The conspiracy theories, the rorts, the everything. So 500 tickets are for corporates then and 1,500
are. No, 500 tickets are for that other team.
Oh, how come you get 1,500? Because you've got a home game.
It's our home game. I said, are you sure you have to give them 500? And he said, yeah, unfortunately, yeah. This is the lovely Adam at the Port Adelaide Football Club who's become a close personal friend over the years. Anyway, Nikki Moffat, I digress and I have taken this over and turned it into a football podcast, of which it is not.
Oh, I'm shocked, I say.
And we are, of course, an expat podcast, which means we kick off with four fat expat questions. We have some light and some not so very light expat questions. I think we're going to tackle one of the hard ones today, Nikki, but I'm going to kick off with something light for you, and that is, Nikki, you're moving or you're traveling, although I think this would be a heavy thing to travel with. But you're moving and you want to move your desktop computer. Do you pop it in your hand luggage and hand carry it, or do you check it in as additional baggage, or do you say, not in a million years would I do either and I'm putting it in a container when I move for good?
Well, I wouldn't do any of those three things, to be honest, for my desktop computer. What I have done in the past with a desktop computer is put it in air freight. So when we were lucky enough in one of our moves, it's weird because we didn't have it every move, but we were lucky enough to have an air freight component. And so I put our desktop computer, which is still with us, never gets turned on, but it's in the study, it's in the playroom on the desk, but still with us. And when it was our main computer, we did move it with air freight. So I would be reticent about putting it in a container because it is containers, you know, they can be touch and go in terms of damage or, you know, your friendly rat community, the mice.
I've done
from
that.
Libya to Canada.
Yes.
There's all sorts of things that can go wrong in a container. So I'd say air freight or hand luggage, probably wouldn't check it in as additional baggage. Kirstie, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I was amazed to read of how many people have checked it in as additional baggage and swore by it and said it was absolutely fine. I wouldn't in a gazillion years, Nikki. I would have been terrified. Having seen the amount of strollers we've gone through that have been chucked onto the carousel, no. But I do have a husband who is an obsessive box keeper, like every phone, every iPad, iPad, every laptop, every electrical item. It's one of those things in our marriage where I'm forever trying to ditch the box and put it in the recycling, and he's forever self-righteous when it comes to that time when, oh, lucky we've got the box still, which drives me insane. But we have hand carried our monster desktop Mac from Qatar to Adelaide. Same story. We've had it over 10 years and it's a big old Mac and it's sitting about a meter away from me now because I can't use it to podcast because I don't think it has the technology inside it to do that. But it does have, you know, some old bits and pieces. And if somebody else needs, like you said, if you need that extra computer, it's there. But my tips for people would be, alas, yes, it's true, keep the box. Get yourself some bubble wrap and some styrofoam. Write info all over the box. I would hand carry the HD to ensure you don't lose your data, and just obviously back up everything on a hard drive before you go. But one thing we do hand carry every summer is the PlayStation. Are you PlayStation people at your house?
We have Xboxes and PlayStations. Yes. We have too many Nintendo. We have too many playing devices.
Right. And do you hand carry them for a summer?
Well, no, because we've never done a summer like you do. So
yes.
We don't go somewhere for a set period of time, sort of 6 to 8 weeks or more. Like your summers are really long for me. It always feels like you're in Australia for a long time.
I am.
And so we have actually never done that. We... when the kids were little and they were given, I think, an Xbox for a gift, we certainly, Santa lugged it to Australia from Hong Kong and then was set up for Christmas Day and then we lugged it back. But no, we haven't sort of every time taken it. So no, but who hand carries it? The person who wants to play it the most, or how does that work?
Yeah, usually the smallest person in the house has the least amount of luggage. Because they're, as in clothing. They get it. And usually it's the smallest person in the house that's the most desperate about wanting it to come. It's not massive, I have to say. It's probably the size of a laptop. But then it's the controllers and the everything else. But yes.
Oh, it's all the extra stuff. Yes. Yeah. And the charging and all the cords. And there's a lot of schmozzle that goes with it. Okay, Kirsty, keeping it a little bit lighter, did your kids jump forward 6 months or settle in for 6 months when they changed hemispheres for schooling, particularly when they went back to Australia?
I'm gathering this is a self-motivated question, Nikki, for you.
It is a self-motivated question, but I also did notice that it had come up in the Two Fat Expats Facebook group a couple of times recently, because it's moving season. People are thinking about moving. People are thinking about changing at the end of the year and in the middle of the year. And it's a question. And my kids have done both, but now I'm like looking at settling someone in for the final stretch. And I'm just interested in your experiences.
Yeah. Look, we've done both for different reasons. I have two children who are only 14 months apart. So they're only a school year apart. So when we moved to Qatar from America, they could have almost been in the same school year. And one kind of, the elder one went back. And so the younger one just sort of scraped in, if that meant to be in the lower school year. So that kind of made it a bit screwy when we then had to move back.
Yeah. And so what supports were needed then for him, or if any?
None.
He's just a brilliant child.
No, he's not a brilliant child. And this is the thing, Nikki. We talk all the time about how lax I am and how uninvolved I am. And, you know, that this is not my thing. Do you know, like
but if he was struggling, you would know and you would be able to offer something.
Yeah, yes. If he was struggling, I would know. And I think, do you know, this stuff always works itself out. So what sort of happened with him? So because this, I mean, what you're kind of asking, I think, is one of the number one questions for all expat parents is how is my children going to slot into the system at home? Am I in front or am I behind? I think the truth is, if you're lucky enough that what was covered the year before at your previous school is what is on the agenda at your next school, you will be seen as being brilliant. Whereas, you know, it might be that you just learned something at a different time. So what I have found with my kids is, you know, there have been some things they have been particularly good at because the school that they were at excelled in that. And then there's been things where they've been not so good and they've had to work harder. That's why I think people shouldn't be too stressed about it, because it will work itself out.
Yeah. So I was looking from the point of view of how old they are when they leave. So your kids are going to their final few years. So
yes, that's the
most common for children to be 18 in Australia, sometimes 17 when they leave, and definitely 18 when they leave school.
And 19 would feel too old.
19 would feel too old. So that's where my daughter, who has been, she's fallen back because she started in South Africa, they start school late. So when she moved to the US, they wouldn't let her go up a grade. They made her go back to start kindergarten again, which she was most unhappy about. But so now, and she's come here, and now if she goes to Australia and repeats, she'll be 19 when she leaves school. So does that extra 6 months. And I think it's more important that she's 18 when she leaves school, and we'll work out the middle bit in between. Because I that's how I'm feeling. Like if she turns 18 in grade 11 when all her friends are 16 and 17, I find that difficult. I just think every state is different and every state has their average age.
Yes.
My nieces are going and nephews going through school there, so I'm kind of working it on the way, and most kids are 18 when they leave school. Yes. So that's all I'm working through with it.
Yeah. I think because people tried to tell me when I was looking at my third child and putting him into year 10, and should I have really put him into year 9, that was exactly my thought. It was, he will end up being 19 in year 12. Now, for anyone who's in the Northern Hemisphere thinking, well, why is that such a big deal? 18 is the drinking age. 16 is the driving age. So you, by the time turning 18 in year 12 is huge, I think, anyway, because they're allowed to go to the pub. They're allowed to go and have a beer. Yeah. And there they are, you know, still going to school. So to be 19 would seem, you know, a very childlike experience for a 19-year-old, wouldn't it, to still be putting your school uniform on and going. So, yeah, the only thing I would advise is don't do it the other way. Don't do it the younger, because I think there's also...
Don't try and be younger. Yeah. Like, do it. Yeah, and that's why, I mean, my kids have changed hemispheres twice in their schooling. And, you know, as my son tells everyone, I can't write cursive because I missed half of third grade to move to America. So, you know, it is, and then other times he's repeated, sort of done the extra half a year. So there's all sorts of bits and pieces that in the younger years, I think. But I think when you're coming towards the end of school and you're trying to make the decision at the end, it just might have a little bit more impact in the post-school life.
Okay. So, Nikki, have you ever been to an expat friend's funeral in another country? And I guess the reason I ask is, have you sort of thought about it? You know, what would you like at your funeral? And would you like your expat life to be acknowledged? And would you be disappointed if it wasn't?
Yeah, so I've been to an expat friend's funeral, but I went, they had moved back to Australia. So she became ill. She had cancer and they were living in Vietnam. And so they moved back to Australia for her to have treatment. And then she had passed away sometime 18 months after that. So I have been to a funeral. I was living in South Africa at the time. And I, thankfully, that's the only one I've been to. A lot of people came from Vietnam, like to be there at the funeral. So I think that because of that, her expat life or their expat life was acknowledged, that the time they had spent living overseas. I don't know. I have this thing about funerals. When old people die, the photo they put on the program is of the person like 2 weeks before they died. You know, there's all these photos of old people. And I think, why can't we have a photo of their 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s? Because they had all this life. And it seems when people pass away or die that people concentrate, like they talk big picture, but they really talk about and like seems to focus on the experiences of the last few years. And I think that's not a person's whole life. I think, you know, that person went to school and, you know, had their first job and, you know, that sometimes gets mentioned, but it's not, I think that every part of your life you live feels so, every part should be acknowledged. And so therefore I think if I end up living overseas for 20 years and then go back to Australia, I think that should be in there. I think we should mention it, touch on it, because it's made a huge part of who I am. I think a lot of the way I think things, a lot of the way I do things, a lot of the way I behave about things are because of I've lived this life. So, yes, I would expect that it be included or incorporated, you know, in some way. But it's incredibly difficult because funerals are for the people who are still alive. They're not really for the people who've passed away.
Yes.
So it's the person who is organizing and generating that. So if you are a person who feels that it's an important part of your life, then put it in your folder, put it in your death file, put it in your thing. These are the things that I want to talk about. These are the things that are important to me. These are the things that have been important to me in my life. And then whoever is organizing your funeral, absolutely honor that, because that's one thing. They do say funerals are for the living, and that's true. And having organized my mother's, I totally understand that. And, you know, we did things that she probably wouldn't have done, but we thought we wanted it that way. But she had a lot of say in it. And I think that that's important. So if you feel, you know, things are important, then, you know, get your clippings and your newspaper clippings and your printouts of whatever articles or whatever and pop them in the file. And so when someone comes to look at and respect your life and celebrate your life, then they'll find the things that you found were important.
Oh, that's so true. That is a really, really good point. And, yeah, you raised it that they are for the people that are still around, aren't they? I mean, what do you care after it's all done? But I always feel that is one of the hardest things for expats. You know, that's why we suffer so much with our repatriation, because we feel that expat life just dies and it's not to be spoken about, because we're all meant to be moving on and settling back in and we're all meant to be so happy to be back home. I thought it was interesting in the Facebook group the other day, a woman was asking about funeral culture, and she was saying that a girlfriend's brother had died, and this was a girlfriend who'd moved back to Canada, and she really felt for this girlfriend and she wanted to go to the funeral because this woman was Irish, and so for her, as someone who is Irish, well then that would be exactly how you would pay your respects to your friend. You would go and you would be a part of it. And so there was a whole conversation about, she wrote, you know, would this happen in Canada, or is it just weird if I rock up? Because I think the Irish really do their funerals really, really well too. And they really do gather and talk and, you know, do the bedside, you know, wander and the whole thing. It's beautifully done. But, it got me thinking, because I don't know, I would hope that your expat friends would never think, oh, this is a bit weird if I go to, you know, see them.
Sure. I mean, what about your father-in-law passed away, and he was an expat for a lot of years. So what happened at his funeral?
Yeah, you've just made me think of something, because he was an expat for a number of years, and he had been back in Australia for a long time. So I'm thinking maybe 20 years he'd been back in Australia. But one of the things that was really special to my mother-in-law was that the company that he ran, that where he was an expat, two people came on behalf of that company and came to show their respects. Now, they didn't know him or he hadn't worked with them, but they came on behalf of that company. And I think, yeah, that was huge for her that that happened, because I think for her, when they talked about their expat life, because it was that, you know, 1970s, early 80s expat life, it is the royal we. Do you know, everything they do is we worked for, or we did this. So, yeah, so obviously for her it was a big deal, because it was nice to think that someone had acknowledged all your hard work and how you'd put yourself out. I mean, I remember, Nikki, I had a moment with, my husband had worked for a company for 11 years, and in that 11 years we had four babies, which meant that there were many times in our relationship and in our marriage where it would be, hey, we're moving to Libya. Oh, but I'm 9 months pregnant and about to have a baby. All right, well, you're going to move to Libya with a two-week-old baby. Or, you know, hey, we're going to take your husband to New York for 3 weeks. Oh, but I have three children under three. No probs. Do you know, that constant relationship with your partner's work where they are messing with you basically and saying, you know, oh, do you want to go to Nigeria? You're going to go to Nigeria. Oh, no, you're not. Oh, yes, you are. Oh, no, you're not. Oh, maybe you will. Oh, actually, no, maybe you'll go to Tunisia. Oh, no, you won't. You know, just constant thing. And so you tell yourself when you're going through all of that, we're doing this for a reason. Like, this is for a common good, you know, like people are going to appreciate that we did this. And when you get to a certain age, and I hate to sound like a cynical old bag expat, but you get to a certain age and you go,
the company doesn't care.
They don't care. And there's nobody keeping a note of this in a folder. There's nobody saying, gee, wasn't Kirsty amazing when she drove into the office with that bag of clothes for that guy that came into Canada for work, and he'd lost his luggage. And so she bought him a jacket and another suit and whatever, and it was minus 21. Nobody says, gee, she was good. Nobody. So I think, maybe that's why it's important. We need someone to recognize what we did, what it was all about, that it actually really did happen.
Yeah, and I wonder now in the new age of COVID, or what we're dealing with at the moment, where a lot of funerals are online. So a lot of funerals are restricted in terms of people's attendance. And so now now it's more common to have a celebration of life or a funeral service where it is live streamed, and so more people can attend and feel that that's a thing. Whereas if you're sitting in a church full of people, there's the camera, you know, like, I think that there will probably be more ways that people moving forward
can attend,
cooperate and attend. Or
you seriously can just dial it in.
No, but not in a bad way. Not as in, oh, I really meant to go to that funeral in that country next week, but I'm just going to dial it in. Like, in a way that people who really meaningfully want to be part of it are able to do that. So anyway, that's maybe something for that side of things. Kirsty. In this week, in this time, in this episode, I'd say it's pretty difficult to ignore what's going on in the world right now, outside of coronavirus and the economic fluctuations of the stock markets. It's a really often discussed topic in the expat world, and even the word expat itself can appear to have racial connotations. And just for global and time-wise context, this is the week in 2020 where there's been a lot of protesting globally and support of the Black Lives Matter movement. So the question is, are international schools as diverse as they appear to be with their flag parade on International Day? Or is there some unfortunate undercurrent at play?
Nikki, You shared a post with me last night. It was an article an amazing woman called Rachel Engel had written. It's called An Open Letter to the International School Community and Our Role in the Black Lives Matter Movement. And Nikki, I had, when I read this and I said this to you at the time, I felt like someone had written everything that I just hadn't been able to articulate or get my head around over the years. Do you know when you've got that sinking feeling, like you're sitting at International Day and you're watching the International March and you're thinking, this all appears great, but there's something not right here and I can't quite work out what it is that just isn't right. Now, you know when you said often even the word expat can appear to have racial connotations, I thought,
yes,
in part of Rachel's article, she'd written that sociologists William Robinson and Jerry Harris had called this phenomenon the TCC, the transnational capitalist class. And that's, yes. And you can't really argue with it. When you look at international schools and many of the international schools that I've been a part of, and they're full of incredible diversity of nations, in that you may have 76 different nationalities at your school. But really, culturally, I'm not sure how diverse they are, in that you're saying, yes, there's so many different nationalities, but they tend to all be incredibly privileged children. A lot of international schools do not offer scholarships for local students. So if you have local students, they are the wealthy. That's definitely the case in Qatar. And so while it is amazing that you may have, you know, your children are at school with ambassadors' children, or, you know, head of engineering firms or construction firms or all sorts of things, you know, but even when I think of people who've started businesses, I have a girlfriend who's managed to start up an incredibly successful nursery school business, and so her children go to the school, but it is phenomenally expensive. And so you are incredibly privileged to go to these schools. So yes, my feeling is that there is perhaps a level of tokenism, and that we really need to think more, listen more, and be better at what we're doing in our international school systems.
Yeah, I would say that. And we also have, I think, something like 70-something nationalities at our school, but if you just stand in the hallway and look, you don't actually see that many people that look different. Mm. And we also have within our school issues regarding, you know, we say it's bullying, but, you know, it can also be flagged as racism in a way, but we don't ever think of it as racism because we don't acknowledge, because we say, we being the collective we of the school, that our school is so diverse. We have all these students. We're very tolerant. You know, we all sit next to someone from a different country. We all sit next to someone who's slightly different to us, but it's not really enough. And there is an incredible privilege. And I feel like us two white ladies sitting here talking about privilege is a difficult thing. Yes. But I think it's a time to acknowledge it. And it's a time to say that we're all constantly learning and understanding so much. And I would have to say, when I first went to the US, and white privilege was a very big catchphrase at the time. And people would say, oh, you know, white privilege, you know, whatever, poor white people, you know, exist, etc. And I would think back to our time in Asia and our time in South Africa and just think, no, white privilege is a thing. Even in countries that are majority black citizens, there are still things if you have lighter color skin, that you get different treatment in different situations. So I just think that it's something that schools, and I know that Kirsty, we were discussing also offline how this is seen differently amongst different people. So you were discussing a post regarding a school that had been on one form of social media that had one set of reactions and feedback, and then when it moved to another form of social media where there are a lot more younger people, there was a whole different set of reactions and feedback.
Kaboom.
And so I think that
it exploded.
I'll explain that, Nikki, in that an international school had put on its Facebook page that they supported Black Lives Matter, and that they, that there was no place for racism within the school, et cetera, et cetera. And on the Facebook page, of course, it was full of parents. And so the parents were all writing, this is why I chose this school for my kids. And someone wrote, although my children don't go to this school, this is why I wish they did. And, well done, well done. And then when it got on to Instagram, where, of course, there's a lot more younger people, they were absolutely slammed with people saying, well, if you're not racist, how come this, this, and this happened? And it was students telling their stories. They called out certain teachers, they called out things that, happen within the school where you have lower paid jobs go to certain people, that you have token teachers, whether they're language teachers or whatever that come, that when you really break it down and look around, you look at, oh yeah, most of the people in a position of power are like this, and the others that aren't are like this. There's this term called performative activism, and I think about that with international schools, of when we have these international days where we reel out everyone and we have our global active citizens. But you go, but what are you actually really, really doing? What are we doing? But I understand how, If you are a parent of a young student and you've gone from living out in the burbs of wherever you're from, and then you hit your expat world and you send your child off to this expat school, it is breathtakingly beautiful when you first see that there is a classroom full of students who are all of different religions and race, and you look at them all playing together and you think, this is the most tremendous thing and it's giving me the best feeling. But I think also what happens with expats is that's how we convince ourselves that we're doing the right thing being away from our friends and our family. So we sell ourselves.
Look at what we're doing.
Yes, we sell ourselves the story. Oh, it's okay that we're not with grandma and granddad and that we're not, at home, because my child's having this amazing, authentic expat experience, where they're friends with people of all nations. And, we have all these different, groups where they learn so much. They've learned two languages, they've traveled, whatever. And, even down to, Nikki, it goes into then when they go on their, social trips to go and build schools in other countries and do all this stuff. But when you look back at it, you go, oh God, there is something really icky here. Really, really icky. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a performative process. Well, as a performative activism, as in the school can present one thing and not really have to address the other issues, because they're like, no, this is what we are. Yes. And someone said to me, it's all very well to say that, but you've got to do the action and you've got to do the work to make it happen.
Yes.
And, you shouldn't go out saying how great you are at one thing until you really assess whether you are great at that and whether you need to do some work on it. So
yes.
Anyway,
yes,
that's our contribution to this conversation from the expat perspective for today.
Yes.
Favorite things, Kirsty.
All right.
What have you got?
I've got three quirky things. Number one is we've made new friends. Greg's got a new, I call him his new bum cancer buddy. Greg made a friend, which I love, because something happens when you get cancer. I can say this because for those who don't know, both my husband and I have both had cancer. We are the cancer experts. But when you get cancer, people love to tell you their stories of who they know who also had cancer. You know, you should meet my auntie. She also had cancer. She ate lots of turmeric and now she's great. And so
turmeric, magical, so magical.
She had green smoothies for a month and that fixed her. Anyway, my lovely G was told, hey, you should give this guy a call. You know, he had bum cancer, as I now like to refer to it as well. And he didn't. And this person, this friend of ours, was just really persistent. No, 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 you should give him a call. You'd really like him. Anyway, eventually G did, and he did really like him. And they have been having these constant sort of phone calls and whatever. And then G went out. This guy, another great reason to really like him is he's got a really good winery down the road. And so G went to his winery and they became friends.
Can't believe it took so long to call him then.
And it turns out, bizarrely, this guy went to the same school as Greg in Melbourne. It was, you know, only a couple of years ahead of him, bloody blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we've had their whole family over for dinner last night. They've also got four kids. Had them for dinner, but he used the phrase when he talked about, we were talking about something else, and then he used the phrase Roger the Lodger, which is what I've decided to call Greg's bum cancer from now on, is that he's got Roger the Lodger and that we're trying to kill Roger the Lodger with chemo and radio. He needs to get out. We're going to kick Roger the Lodger out. So that's one of my favorite things. I know that's not the usual treat that we do, Nikki, with reading, listening or whatever, but I thought from now on I'm referring to it as Roger the Lodger. Also, Ottolinghi. I've got to go back. I've talked about this simple cookbook before, but I am back on it big time. And last night I did the roasted cauliflower with the pomegranate seeds and the pistachios, and you put in the cauliflower leaves and you roast them as well. If anyone doesn't have the Ottolinghi Simple is the name of it, it's a yellow and white cookbook, go and get it. You will not be disappointed. Or if you can copy some recipes from a friend or look online, it is totally worth it. And my last thing, Nikki, is I watched the Lance Armstrong doco. Did you watch that at all?
I have not watched the Lance Armstrong doco. We're on totally different television viewing schedules at the moment, you and I, Kirsty, which is not unusual, but tell me about
it. So everyone's been raving about The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, which was really good.
Yes.
10 episodes, really, really good. A whole insight into that era. And Lance kind of got lost in it because his doco came out.
It was competing.
Kind of at the, yeah, it was. And it was on ESPN. It was, you know, another sports doco. So it runs over two nights. There's part one and two. And it is the real deal of Lance telling you about being a drug cheat. And it shows you that Lance has no regrets. Because he keeps telling you he has no regrets. He is just, interestingly, between my husband, and my husband is a cyclist, my husband watched it and said, oh yeah, but he was still, it just shows you what a great athlete he was. And I was finding myself getting angrier and angrier and angrier because I was thinking, this man is awful. Like, he's an asshole. He still can't see that what he did was so wrong. And yes, they were all cheating. They were all drug cheats.
Everyone else did it.
Everyone else did it. And I had one of those moments where I was sitting, Greg was, you know, on the couch next to me, and he kept saying, but you can't deny he was a great athlete. He was a great athlete. You know, he did this, he did that. And I was like, no, but he, you know, he was a liar and he was this and whatever. Anyway, I wandered off and then I thought, no, that's what it is. And I stopped back to the lounge room and said, it's because he sold the whole story of the cancer victim. That's it. It was because he marketed his cancer recovery, and he was so full on about being an anti-drug person and mocked those. He was impossibly awful to a lot of women in his life, and used awful, horrendous terms to describe them and talk about them. And yeah, my telling moment, because I always think you can tell a lot about people by how they treat their partners and their children. And there is a moment where he goes to visit his son who plays football at college, and he is asked to do the pre-match or the pre-training address, and he talks and he says, you know, obviously I'll be looking at number 45 tonight. And you see afterwards his son has to say, Dad, I'm not number 45. I'm number 38. It's, yeah. So, look, I think it's really good watching, but you might get angry. But I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, no, you're so right about the reasons you're angry about it. And my husband is of the opinion that you should just let everyone do drugs and run the Olympics. Just do it and see a 3 second 100 meter final.
Yeah.
He said, you know, the whole thing is that everyone is doing them. So just be open. And then yeah. And I said, but then it's the best drug program wins. He said, yeah, well, you got to stop somewhere, don't you? So, but I understand what you do. And I have a friend who is actually an expat, but I knew him before he was an expat. And he works for Nike. I don't know how you say it these days. And he is a mad cyclist. And he went through the whole roller coaster of Lance Armstrong because he's been a cyclist as long as I've known him. So he was he's the greatest athlete ever to – I can't believe he's done drugs, he's ruined my life, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he did the highs and lows, and I saw him just be so disillusioned by having this hero who was an amazing athlete. And then, you know, because of the cancer story. And particularly in what you just said about the treating women, and it's so true, it's another man with power who used that situation to further himself from the truth, because that was the things that were trying to sort of eating around the edges. So he just diverted attention. Hey, look over here, look what I'm doing. So I just really think, I would be interested in looking at it because I've heard a couple of people talk about it as well. So yes. Kirsty, on the same level, just my favorite things, obviously very esoteric, high level, brain inducing. No, so last week I had a phone call on the weekend from my husband who was in Denmark, and he didn't come home on the weekend because he's coming home next week to proctor my son's grade 11 exams because they'll be doing exams from home and we have to have someone do supervision. So anyway, he rang and said, look, that book review you did, I don't know why I'd bother reading the book now. You told me everything that happens. And I said, it's actually not true. There's a lot of things I didn't tell you. And you need to read it. Anyway, so on that note.
What was the name of that book again?
It was called Rodham.
Rodham, that's
by,
right.
By Curtis Sittenfeld. And it's in the show notes from last week. But this week I am listening to a new book called The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes by Suzanne Collins. And it's the prequel to The Hunger Games. Now, I don't know if you're a Hunger Games person, Kirsty, and read all Games books.
I am not, but my children did.
Well, they might be interested in this book. So audiobooks have obviously always existed because they existed for sight-impaired people. But now Audible is open to the world. Now, I don't know whether you do this, but when I was little, I used to read books, and when I'm bigger too, obviously, and there were words that I didn't understand or names I didn't get, and I just sort of made up a thing in my mind. So it just sort of went on. And every time I saw that word in the book, I just – whatever word I thought in my head came up. So I wasn't necessarily reading because I never read them out loud, so to speak. So I wasn't necessarily reading the whole thing. So in The Hunger Games, I decided, for example, Hermione in Harry Potter. So when I first read Hermione, when I first started reading the books, I don't think I knew it was Hermione. So I just was like, Herm.
Oh, yes. This is like my husband, Siobhan, who's Siobhan.
There you go. Siobhan. Yeah. There you go. So anyway, so in the book, so the prequel goes back to, now in The Hunger Games, there is a person called President Snow, and he is the head of the baddies, so to speak. And he has a first name. And that first name in my mind, I just always washed over it. It was one of those quite long names, and just always washed over it. And now this prequel is about him as a teenager and how he went down this path, I guess. And so every time they say his name, it's like a little shock to me. It's like, that's how they say his name. And if I tried to say it out loud now, I couldn't. But it's one of those things that now I'm listening to the book. Every time they say it, I'm like, oh. And it's just one of those, because in the old books, in the old trilogy, it was one of those names I just washed over, you know. Yes. So anyway, but I listened to it last night, so I've listened to about 2 hours of it on my walk and when I got home and pottering
around
last night.
All the same characters? It just gives you the lead up to what The Hunger Games was about?
No, not the same characters because, the same land, the same world, but because in The Hunger Games he's quite old, like he's 80 and president in The Hunger Games, and he's 18 now. So this is like a historical back view on the Hunger Games and how he became involved in them and what his background is and everything. Anyway, it's quite good. I'm enjoying it so far. I'm a couple of hours in. I can't give you any spoilers except to say it's about when he was younger and how he was involved in the Hunger Games. Cool. So interesting. Okay. I would strongly recommend if you're a Hunger Games fan. Now, the TV show I was watching this week was The Great. It's on Hulu, and I know it's also on Stan if you're in Australia. Yes. And it's about Catherine the Great, but it's a comedy. And it's actually based on a play written by an Australian guy, apparently, who wrote a comedic play about Catherine the
Great. I've seen the shorts of this. It looks good.
Yeah. It is quite good. Now, there's recently also been a TV show called, I think, Catherine, where it was a very serious one, a dramatic representation of Catherine the Great and all the things that she did in Russia during her reign. But basically, Catherine the Great, it's historic, so I'm not spoiling it for anybody. she married the Emperor of Russia and then basically staged a coup. And took leadership herself and went on from there to rule Russia and to bring great changes into Russia and the population. But it is a comedy, and it's very quirky, and it's a little bit funny. But it in addressing such a serious topic, it's a little bit, it feels sometimes a bit weird. Right. But it's almost like an hour show. Like if it was on TV, it would be an hour show. I think the episodes are sort of 46 to 50 minutes. So it does do the full 1 hour comedy drama kind of thing. So anyway, if you're thinking about it, have a look because I've quite enjoyed it. And my last thing quickly is 13 Reasons Why season 4 has started, and it's the top rating show on Netflix.
I can't believe they are up to season 4. Like I was there for season 1. I might even have been there for season 2, but God, I can't even imagine what season 3. Do people keep dying? Or
that's the thing, right? That's always someone dying. They have announced that season 4 is the last season in this final season of 13 Reasons Why. And it does seem to be addressing mental health, so teenage mental health and anxiety and very current issues. And I thought, season 4, do I really want to watch it?
Yes.
I thought, oh, well, I'll give it a whirl last night. So I watched the first episode and a half or so, and I got sucked right back in. So I don't know if I'm going to watch it religiously, like every second I get, and that's all I'll watch till I finish it. But it's, you know, I was very skeptical, and then I watched the episode and I thought, oh, yeah, I remember this. This is why I liked it. So I'm back in there.
Lovely.
13 Reasons Why.
Okay. All right. Maybe I might give it a go. Nikki, we've made it. We're nearly at the hour mark. The reason we're both so overjoyed that we did make it is that I think it took us about 10 attempts to actually get into this space to record and do this with the whole internet dropping out and let me just restart my computer and oh, here we are, bang, no, we're not here. Oh, can you hear me? I can't hear you. But we made it. We made it.
We made it. We made it. Good chatting. Right. Great chat. And I'll speak to you next week. Oh, I'll see you on Friday. So this week we will do a Friday.
Sounds great. I will see you Friday.
Bye-bye. Bye.